Welcome to the Oral History of New York. I'm your host, Brad Bailey. The spoken word is the foundation of all storytelling. Oral history is the story of who we are. This show looks at the past and present stories of New York through the eyes of those who have lived it, experienced it, and created it. The story of New York is the story of America, and each week we will highlight the stories around us that give us insight into our great city and country. On today's episode, we talk about the activist response to violence in America and the different expression of that protest throughout the years. We go back a century to a protest for social justice, and we also talk to African-American mothers who have lost their sons to violence. On July 28, 1917, 10,000 African-Americans paraded down Fifth Avenue in Manhattan. What's so striking about this event was that it was completely silent. It was known as the Silent Parade, and it was organized by the NAACP to protest violence directed toward African-Americans across the country. This was an extraordinary time for the U.S. because of recent involvement in the First World War. James Weldon Johnson was the field secretary of the NAACP at that time and was widely credited with organizing the march. Johnson was a Renaissance man of that era and was a writer, activist, and leader. He became well known during the Harlem Renaissance of the 1920s for his poems, novels, and anthologies. He composed the lyrics to Lift Every Voice and Sing, considered the African-American national anthem. In 1934, he was the first African-American professor to be hired at New York University. On Christmas Eve in 1935, James Weldon Johnson met with Columbia speech professor George W. Hibbett to record the speech lab recordings. Here's a recording of one of Johnson's famous poems, We to America, which references the African-American experience in America.
We to America, how would you have us, as we are, or sinking neath the load we bear? Our eyes fixed forward on a star, or gazing empty at despair? Rising or falling, men or things, with dragging pace or footsteps fleet, strong, willing sinews in your wings, or tightening chains about your feet.
We speak to Dr. Melissa Barton, curator of American literature, drama, and prose writings at Yale University. She works in the James Weldon Johnson Memorial Collection at the Beinecke Library, which documents and celebrates the cultural and artistic achievements of African Americans. She gives us an insight into the Silent Parade of 1917.
Oh, so I was saying the Beinecke Library, which is the main rare book and manuscript library at Yale, has the papers of James Weldon Johnson. We have a collection, an overarching collection called the James Weldon Johnson Memorial Collection of African American Arts and Letters, which was founded by Carlton Becton, who you mentioned, and named for Johnson, who was a civil rights leader. He was executive secretary of the NAACP. He also was a poet, a novelist, a songwriter, professor of literature. He had a very multifaceted career. And he was the mastermind behind the silent protest parade in 1917. So he had actually just started working for the NAACP at the end of 1916. As a field secretary, he was working, trying to open NAACP offices in the South, very dangerous work. And the massacre happened, a series of massacres happened in East St. Louis, Illinois. And the NAACP wanted to plan a response to it. They actually talked about having a rally at Carnegie Hall. And Johnson said, he had had this idea suggested to him some time ago to have a silent march down Fifth Avenue. And he said, we should do that. And so they decided they were going to plan that protest. And Johnson worked with several church leaders from African-American neighborhoods in New York City, not Harlem, but also other African-American areas in New York City. He planned with these church leaders to have the march, which began at the corner of Central Park on Fifth Avenue and marched all the way down to Madison Square, marched right past where Trump Tower stands today on Fifth Avenue. In silence, they had a drum corps leading them. And then there's most crowd estimates put the number of people at around 10,000 people marching in silence, in formation, you know, in rows, carrying these signs that really, you know, indicted the U.S. for its failures to protect Black people from violence.
Although Johnson and the parade was in New York, just like today, they were protesting injustices around America, specifically the violence in East St. Louis, a city in Illinois, across the river from St. Louis, Missouri.
So in 1917, in May and then again in July of 1917, there were a series of attacks on African-American communities in East St. Louis by white mobs. So again, historical estimates vary, but between 50 and 200 people were murdered by white mobs, and homes were burned by arsonists. About 6,000 people were made homeless by these attacks. So the first one happened in May. The second one happened July 2nd, I think, 1917, and it was in response to that that the NAACP decided to plan the march.
In addition to East St. Louis, there are other incidents of racial violence all across America, some of which have been in the news recently.
Tulsa was in 1921. So, and actually in between 1917, East St. Louis, and 1921, Tulsa was the famous 1919 series of racial violence and unrest throughout the United States in 1919, which James Alden Johnson is usually credited with giving that summer its name, Red Summer. Many organizations observed the 100th anniversary of Red Summer last year. But there were uprisings and attack, you know, violent clashes in Chicago, in Washington, D.C., in Omaha, in several cities throughout the United States in the summer of 1919, which is usually credited with conflict related to the Great Migration. So many African Americans are moving from the southern United States to northern cities and competing, then creating competition for jobs with white workers in those cities. It's the participation of African Americans in World War II and their kind of gaining recognition in that way, even though they were participating in a segregated army. There were many lynchings of Black soldiers in 1919. So the kind of increase in movement of Black people around the country and this kind of backlash of white supremacy that's happening against them at this time. So that series of incidents, 17, 19, and then Tulsa, Greenwood in 1921, were all kind of part of the same kind of inflammatory unrest that's going on throughout the country.
You're right. Because of that Great Migration, a lot of African Americans had started leaving the South. And so this outbreak of violence in different places had sort of, again, as you say, had sort of been created as a result of that migration. And, you know, because, again, a lot of people had assumed that the violence had been just in the South, but this is the first time that violence had been all over the country, sort of with African Americans, correct? Or was that sort
yeah,
of
a, and, and in 19 in East St. Louis, the inciting incident that is, you know, pointed to is that Black workers are strike breaking, right? They're participating in their white workers are trying to mount a strike. They don't let Black workers be in their union. So, Black workers, are accused of strike breaking, and that's what incites these violent attacks. So often there are, there will be like an inciting incident that gets pointed to, but that these are increasingly happening in northern cities. Obviously, you know, maybe most people wouldn't consider Tulsa to be in the north, but you know, in that case, here's a prosperous business community that their crime, so-called, is being prosperous, right? So class distinctions or class resentments are considered, I think, a big part of it as well.
Interesting. And so, and also that goes to, again, something I was noticing with regard to the politics of respectability. Could you sort of discuss what that is and sort of how that impacted the Silent March of 2017?
In that era, African Americans believed that the politics of respectability would help achieve their racial justice goals.
Yeah, I think the politics of respectability as a concept is very much alive in the planning of the protest parade. So the, you know, that's a phrase that gets coined by historians to refer to a kind of set of tenets that are held by leaders in Black political circles that, you know, certain actions that, you know, only certain actions will be noticed and, you know, honored by white communities and whites in power as, you know, allowing Black people to have the respectability that they deserve. And so the idea of ideas around comportment and dress and diction, elocution, you know, are held to be these kind of pathways to equality, pathways to freedom by these leaders. You know, there is a lot of then intra-racial policing, you know, intra-racial you know, instruction that goes on that is not uncontroversial, we'll say. But in the silent protest parade, you see these, you know, this parade that is led by children who are carrying signs that say things like "Thou shalt not kill," and then behind them are women wearing white dresses, full-length white dresses, so that they're, you know, dressed in their church clothes. To show that, you know, that they deserve respect, they deserve, you know, equal power, because they are, you know, conforming to these ideas of what is proper. Behind them, you have the men who are dressed in suits, right? So everybody is wearing their best clothes in this, in July, marching down the street in Manhattan. So many scholars and historians have commented on the theatricality of the parade, the aesthetics of it, the way that it was orchestrated. It was incredibly, we have in the collection at Beinecke, we have photographs of it that were saved by James Weldon Johnson. They're really extraordinary to look at, and it's kind of impossible to imagine what it must have looked like, 10,000 people marching in lines, down an empty Fifth Avenue that's been emptied out by the police with an agreement with the city. So it begins with a line of a drum corps. They're playing these drums. Everyone else, you know, then there's a line of leaders behind it. That line includes W.E.B. Du Bois, the editor of The Crisis, the magazine published by the NAACP, James Weldon Johnson standing next to Du Bois, Frederick Asbury Cullen, who was a reverend in the Methodist Church, the father of the poet County Cullen. He was a big organizer of the parade as well. So a line of about 10 leaders, and then behind them, these children, some of them as young as 6 years old, carrying signs. Their signs say things like, "Mother, do lynchers go to heaven? Treat us so that we may love our country. Mr. President, Woodrow Wilson, why not make America safe for democracy?" Right. This is the, you know, on the U.S. is entering on the precipice of entering the World War and talking about making the world safe for democracy when the United States is not safe for its many of its citizens. So those children, and then they're followed by women wearing white dresses. And they're marching behind the children. And then after them, the kind of bringing up the rear guard of the parade are the men who are wearing black suits. And, you know, again, as I said, the crowd estimates are something like, you know, the lowest estimate was 3,000, the highest was something like 12,000, so something like 10,000 people. And then people lined the sides watching them, and no one spoke. James Weldon Johnson in his memoir talks about how not only were they silent, but the onlookers were all silent. And he says, I'm going to quote him. He says, "The streets of New York have witnessed many strange sights, but I judge never one stranger than this, certainly never one more impressive."
Wow. I could not imagine. Especially in New York City, a place like New York City, a parade down Fifth Avenue of just quiet, people just quiet. Because it goes against, I guess, what a lot of people would think a parade would be, especially a parade in New York City. But I think that's just, it's so impressive at just the amount of just, you know, resilience and dignity and strength that these women and men had to undertake in such conditions at the time. What was the impact of the... what was the impact of the parade in the press, if you can recall, during that time, or its impact societally?
the parade was definitely covered in the national press. So it was covered in the Black press throughout the country. So there are articles you can find about it in the Baltimore Afro-American, in the Chicago Defender, these historic Black newspapers covered at the time. The New York Times covered it. So it was definitely noticed in New York City and then throughout the country. Johnson, in his memoir, which he writes in the early 30s, notes that it's, I think, is very measured about its impact. So it was only shortly after this that another very serious set of events takes place in Houston, Texas, on an army base. There is again, kind of violent clash between Black soldiers who were in a segregated regiment stationed there and white soldiers stationed there, and the police get involved and citizens, several people die. And that happened only a short while after this parade. So he kind of connects that to, and then 1919, you know, Red Summer, to this idea that maybe, you know, that this silent protest wasn't kind of the end all and be all of the word on this. But I think he connects it to an ongoing struggle. So I think that the 1917 silent protest parade should be a household name. I think it should be on a par with the March on Washington. I mean, it was to that moment, the largest public demonstration organized by African Americans that had taken place. So I think it should get more attention than it does. It got a lot of attention in 2017 when Beinecke and others observed its 100th anniversary. Google had a Google Doodle based on it, which I think got it some attention. The NAACP had a commemorative protest that they organized. They had to march down 6th Avenue instead of 5th Avenue because Trump Tower is there, and they were not allowed to get the permit to march in front of Trump Tower. But I think that it should be remembered as this action that combined in aesthetics, combined with political power, and recognized, you know, this is that the dawn. I mean, it's considered one of the inaugurating moments of a period we now call the Harlem Renaissance. This moment when aesthetic work, the work of art, the work of performance, can be seen as a kind of political work, and I think that that is as much a part of its legacy as the political work that it did.
No, that's a brilliant point. You're right. That was really at the early beginnings of what people would now consider the Harlem Renaissance, and sort of how much of a societal and sort of social and societal and educational and artistic impact that had, not just in Harlem and New York and the country, but around the world. And so what is the, can you give us a little bit sort of, look, who is James Baldwin Johnson? Who is James Johnson? And sort of who is he as a figure, and sort of what his impact was, not just only on the parade, but also on America?
Sure. So James Weldon Johnson was a political activist, also a writer and a professor of literature. He was born in the 19th century and eventually lives in New York, and becomes a songwriter. He writes novels, he writes history. He was the executive secretary of the NAACP for about a decade. He was the first Black person to hold that office in the NAACP. And he was the leader of their efforts to pass a bill in the United States Senate against lynching, to make lynching a federal crime. That was an effort that he led that NAACP never succeeded in getting that bill passed. He retires from the NAACP to become a professor of literature at Fisk University in Nashville. So he was a multifaceted man, a Renaissance man, we'd like to say, of the Harlem Renaissance, and a very influential tastemaker in that period, kind of elder statesman in the Harlem Renaissance period. He dies tragically in a car accident while vacationing in Maine in 1938. And it was in response to that a committee was formed to create a memorial in his honor. They at first considered trying to erect a statue to him in Central Park at the northern entrance, 110th Street entrance to Central Park. They ended up not managing to do that, but instead they founded a collection in his name at Yale. And so his papers are at Yale, and several people added their papers to the collection as well, including Langston Hughes. Zora Neale Hurston gave us a couple of manuscripts. Claude McKay's papers are there. Quite a few writers associated with that period donated their papers.
So, for example, if somebody wanted to check out that, if somebody wanted to look and see what Yale had in terms of that collection, how possible is it to do that? Can they do it online, virtually? How possible is it to do that?
Yeah, we are still, because of the pandemic, our physical building is closed, but we are always open online. So we have a digital library, which can be reached from our website. And you can search there and also browse through some highlights from the collection. There's a lot of material available there.
I wonder if those parade participants in 1917 would imagine that America would be dealing with this issue 100 years later. Next, we talk to Queen Brown, who lost her son Everton in 2006. She recalls the last conversation she had with him right before he died.
My name is Queen Brown. My son that was murdered October 26, 2006. His name is Everton Brown. My son was shot. He was murdered. One bullet to the back took his life. He was murdered by someone that didn't even know him, someone that never, ever met my son. My son was an unintended target of gun violence. One bullet to his back, and he died instantly. On his death certificate, they say the time of death from the initial wound was instant. His lungs filled up with blood, and he died instantly. My son Everton was a typical all-American 24-year-old young male growing up, developing, evolving, becoming a man right before my eyes. Everton went to public school all of his life. He was raised by a single mom. He was in a program called the 5,000 Role Models, a program that was geared at young black and brown boys, helping them to be able to graduate from school and teaching them social skills. So I wanted to give you an idea of what this program was like and how instrumental this program was. It helped my son to become the man that he desired to be and what I wanted to see. He finished school, we got him out of school, he graduated. He was a typical boy, typical adolescence. I'm not saying he was an angel, but I'm not saying he was some loony, dysfunctional kid either. He graduated, he got a scholarship, he went to school. He was studying civil engineer, very smart, in the math club, loved math, loved science. He went to FAMU, historically black college in Tallahassee, Florida. And while there, he met his girlfriend. She was a student over at FSU, and she became pregnant in his third year of school. She came home to have their child, and he followed after the baby was born. He came home. And he wanted to stay. He wanted to stay home. And I'm like, I begged him, please go back to school. Because I understood the challenges of not having a formal education. Because I, as his mom, I was a high school dropout myself. And as an adult, I had to go back to school and continue my education. And it was very challenging with four children. And I didn't want him to have that struggle. And especially with the child on the way, he didn't take my advice and he decided he would get a job and work. He wanted to buy his girlfriend a ring. He was so proud. He just kept saying, this is the mother of my child. My child is coming. I'm going to buy her a ring. He got a job and he worked on his job for 3 weeks. He didn't even get his first paycheck. He died on payday. He worked the last day of his life. He came home from work. He did a double shift. He went to work at 10 o'clock the Wednesday night, and he was supposed to get off at 6. He called his brother. He texted him and told him he's going to work a second shift. And he worked 6 to 2. I was home that day when he got off from work. I was outside in the yard working, weeding the yard, putting flowers around my palm trees. He pulled up. And as he got out of the car, you know, we kind of just looked at each other and spoke. And I'm like, boy, you look tired. He was like, I am, Mom. I said, you're eating? He said, only if you're cooking. So I said, well, you know, told Mom, your baby want to eat, you stop everything. So I put down what I was doing, went in the house, and I said, how about some eggs and bagels? He said, fine. I fried two eggs, bagel, buttered it up. He liked garlic in his eggs, put a little garlic powder on his eggs, cut his bagel in half. And I asked him, I said, he was sitting on the couch in the living room, so we started talking about his day. That was something I always did with my children. I tried to give them the best life possible. I tried to give them a life that a lot of young men were not privy to. Even in some instances, I didn't have. So conversation was number one. It was critical in my home. So I said to him, I'm in, over there in the kitchen getting the bagel and stuff together. So I said, listen, you can do anything you want to do in this world. I said, but you know what? You have to have a plan. You can't live life aimlessly. I took a yellow legal pad out of the kitchen drawer, blue ink pen, put them together, handed it to him. I said, I want you to write out your life plan. Look, do a SWOT analysis. Look at your strength. I said, your strengths are you're healthy, you're strong, and you're young. That's a strength. And your weaknesses is you don't have a formal education. And that youthfulness, that's a strength, is also a weakness. But you got to know how to use it. Look at the opportunities. You're living in America. This is the most powerful country in the world. Opportunities are unlimited. And your threats, I said, there's a lot of threats out there. And you know what? One of the things I didn't define for him as a threat was also a great threat. I told him the drug dealers on the corners, your homeboys and your behaviors, all those are threats. Law enforcement also was a great threat to him, and he had been pulled over constantly in my car. I have to get it. They think it's stolen. It had been that growing up black in America. He had many encounters. My house is very old school, very warm. Everyone loved to come hang out there during the holidays. So he came in, my nephew came in. Well, he knocked on the door and didn't get an answer. He called my son, he called seven times before my son actually picked up the phone. He woke him up, told him to come ride with him to go pick up his check from his job. We didn't know, but my nephew had been arguing with the guy that was the former boyfriend of his girlfriend, 18 years old. So he became afraid. And those two had argued the day before they worked together. And we later learned my nephew made threats to the guy, and they threatened each other about this 18-year-old girl. So my son was tired. My oldest son said when he got home, my son was leaning over, putting on his shoe, and was like, God, I'm so tired. I don't want to go anywhere. But Josh just asked me to come ride with him. And he left. And it was less than 59 minutes, he was pronounced dead. On the side, inside my nephew's car, my nephew panicked when they shot his car up and drove around with my son's body in there for 27 minutes before rescue was able. Well, the police had to get involved because my nephew was running stop signs and driving in circles. He was panicked. He thought the shooter was still after him. I'm giving you the detail of the story because you asked, but I don't have to. He's that kid in Chicago. He's that kid in Detroit. He's the same boy in San Francisco. Same story, different names. America is a deadly place for young black and brown boys, to the point that is the number one killer, the number one cause of death, homicide, the taking of a life. They're dying for a lot of reasons, a lot of reasons that are controllable. This is shameful. that in a country like this, that any group of people will be dying from preventable causes of death. And we're not doing anything about it as far as leadership, as far as those that are in power. But it speaks volumes to how they value our African American and Black and brown boys. Had this been any other race of color, there would have been an alarm if their children were dying from a preventable cause of death. And I found that out. I had no knowledge. I never even knew. And trust me, I heard stories about shootings in the neighborhood, riding to work, the radio was on. We had a double shooting, we had a homicide, and it was just on the air. It's just something. You just become so accustomed to it until it happened to me. I used to call the medical examiner's office because I wanted to understand. I wanted to know how many bodies do you get a day, how much. And it was at the medical examiner's office where they looked at me like, oh, this was expected. This is nothing new. You didn't know that the Black kids are dying every day. This is normal. Look, I remember they pulled it up on the, see the CDC. You see what's the number one cause of death? At the medical examiner's office. I used to visit them every day. The graveyard, the medical examiner's office. They know me there. I get a report once a month from them. Because I knew when I lost my son and I began to look at the bigger problem, because I realized the reason I lost him wasn't because of his health. It wasn't because of something that I had done in the home. It was something bigger than that. And it not only had it affected my son, but I saw a list of names and ages in race. And they were all my sons. That was my sons just being repeated, a different age, but all within that age group. And it was so profound. And I'm saying to the medical examiner people, well, if we know this, what are we doing about it? Well, they're killing each other, but what are we doing about it? You know, they sat there looking at me like they didn't even have the answers. This is not cancer where we're looking for a cure. We already know this is a preventable cause of death. And you have a population of people that are living in the greatest country in the world, and they're dying at the hands of other people. How can this be so? This is unacceptable. So what I decided to do, I used to tell people, I used to go to schools, I used to go to these community meetings. I started a radio talk program where I paid money out of my pocket to go on air. First, I went to the radio stations and asked them, could I do a show? And they laughed at me. Who's going to listen to, who are you? First of all, they wondered, who are you? I said, I'm Queen Brown. I'm the mother of a murdered son. And it was, you know, I remember specifically one lady said to me, the program manager, so what are you going to talk about? I want to talk about what's happening to our children, about the murders that are... She laughed and threw her head back and leaned back in the chair. She says, are you kidding me? Who's going to listen to that? I says, nobody's listening to it right now because nobody's saying it. But if you let me have a radio program, I have a lot of people listening. They laughed me out of there. And I found a little station, a little radio station where I went in, and it was $40 for a half hour, $80 for an hour, very little AM station. But that was enough. We started with the half hour, and then we moved to an hour. That little talk radio show became one of the hottest talk shows in Miami, on a little radio station, to the point where CNN picked it up. And that's how they made me a CNN hero. They picked that station up because I was talking about what people wanted to hear. See, that's the biggest, that's a big, you know, misunderstood, a wrong narrative. We need to change what they believe about us. We do care about our children, and we do want our children to live. And I would bring on, I had someone from the medical examiner's office to talk about the statistics. Because what drove me to start looking, I didn't want it to get to that point for other parents. I want to tell you ahead of time so you won't become a statistic or your son. And, you know, I brought in different people from different, you know, the police chief, the school superintendent, just everybody from the community. Let's talk about this problem because a lot of mothers don't know, like I didn't know. It's already a statistic for many, many years in this country that black and brown boys will most likely die at the hands of someone else intentionally than anything else. With all the swimming pools in Florida, with all the alligators and the rivers and the beaches, those things are less likely to hurt this kid right here. Your child will most likely die by an intentional death. Had I known that at the time of my son's death, before his death, I would have done a lot of things differently. Someone said it so eloquently today. They come into our communities and don't respect our communities a lot of times because they feel that we don't respect ourselves. I get it every day as an advocate in my community. You know, people ask me, well, why do, especially people maybe representing a different culture or population, why do you guys allow your children to kill each other like that? You know, they make it seem as though we're sitting idly by and we're allowing our children to kill each other. But that's, and you know, I tell people, it's not so cut dry like you think it is that we're allowing it. It's a lot of systems in place that this is a chain reaction. This is just a symptom of a greater issues that's going on in our community. And until we begin to deal with that, first we have to become aware. And once we become aware of the issue, then we could begin to accept it. We got to accept it and own it. We have to own it too. When we don't own the problem, we give it to somebody else and we give them the power. I have to own this. There's something I can do about this. There was something I could have done about a lot of the murders that has taken place in our community. And that's basically what happened to my son.
Finally, on this episode, we hear the story of Burnett McFadden, who lost all three of her sons to violence in less than a year.
My name is Burnett McFadden. I'm from Glen Burnie, Maryland. And my oldest son's name was Linton McFadden. And my next son to the oldest was Randolph McFadden. And my third one was Reginald McFadden. And their ages was, Linton was 20 when he was murdered. Randolph was 18 when he was murdered, and Reginald was 17 when he was murdered. The time period that all three of them was murdered was 6 weeks apart. Linton was actually murdered on Mother's Day that year, and Mother's Day fall, the same day this year. And also, my birthday was in that month. So, and then Reginald was murdered my mother's February 3rd was his birthday, and that's the day my mother died. And Reginald was murdered 4 days after his birthday. And Randolph, my sister, died February 3rd. The 3rd, and my son Randolph died, was murdered February 6th. So during that time, I had a lot of murders, and my son's was murdered. Lynn was murdered by two guys that was robbing him. He had started working at the Walmarts that day. He was down the street from my house, maybe three blocks down from my house. It was at 10. It was like maybe like 11:45 p.m. He had, that day before he left out, he had asked his fiance to marry him, that he's the only one he ever been with. And before he left, he was like, Mom, I'll see you that night. I love you very much. And I gave him a kiss. And the guys had on Halloween masks. Jumped out the car with a 9 tech millimeter to rob my son, made him get on his knees and beg for his life. He had told them that he had no money. They didn't care. He had another young fellow with him. The young boy was 15 at the same time. The two murderers were switching hands with my non-tech, who they was going to point the gun at first. They first pointed at the young man. Then the other guy, the actual murderer, took the gun and pointed at my son, Linton, and triggered. The fear level took my son that they never seen. Actually, the fear level, my son's Linton case is one of the first cases in the state of Maryland that someone took a gun and murdered him, and his fear level went off the meters that they never seen nobody fear level that someone took a gun and it actually sent him in shock, and at the same time that he was murdering him, his fear level both collided at the same time, and it murdered and killed him. Yeah, all the autopsy and everything could tell that. 6 weeks later, my son Randolph was murdered by a friend. At the time, I was out of town in Philly, where I'm from. I'm from Philly, actually from Philly, with family, and it was a friend of a family. His, my goddaughter's mother had turned the gas on in the house and left my child in there to die. It was sad. It was unbelievable. 6 weeks later, I have another goddaughter's, was a friend. They became homeless, and the mother and her daughter and her son came to live with us. Her son didn't respect her, but in my house, you have to either go to school or either go to work. He didn't. He had a knife in his pocket. I was telling her son that he had to go to school or lay down at the time. The mother didn't want to listen to me, and her started passing some words, so I told her she had to leave. So she told him he can go outside. He knocked back on the door. At this point, my son Reginald came down the stairs. He has company because he was graduating from high school. Everything, he was already graduating, getting ready to get his stuff together. And he was tired, so he came down and saw me, and the mother was arguing, and then the young man jumped in my face, and my son immediately defended me, and they started fighting. And when they was fighting, they took the fight outside because it was also nighttime around 10:30 p.m. and it was dark in my backyard because I had a backyard, and they was fighting and stuff. He stabbed my son in the back. At that moment I didn't know that he literally took a knife and stabbed my child in his back, and my son fell in my arms, and bled all over me, and that is what happened to my third son. And at that moment, it's nothing that I could have did. I kind of blame myself because I was, from all three of them, really, because it's the state of shock, a mother's shock. She's a protector of her children. So this is my reality. I am called. My case is different from all other mothers because I'm a mother of multiple children lost. I don't grieve separately for each one of my sons because it's too hard for me to imagine the great loss that I have for three children to be murdered 6 weeks apart. A lot of mothers ask me, how do I explain myself? How do I deal with it and stuff? I gave the gift of life to Ligon Legacy of Maryland because I want someone else to have the gift of life, the joy that I have. I wanted someone else to be able to see the eyes through Randolph. Someone has his eyes. I wanted someone to hear my son's laugh. I wanted someone else to feel the love that I shared as a single mother for four sons. This is the reality that I am to sit here, and I am talking about my sons, but I'm really, their voices are being talked. So I'm not no longer speaking. When I talk about them from now on, they'll be talked about. They're talking about, this is their life. Me living on, having their voice speaking to what happened. No murderer, and understand me well, can never take nothing from me. My moment as I speak about my children or the murder of my children is the power that came from them. This is me. This is how I survived. This is how I gained my power. And this is what a mother looked like, a mother of murdered children. I am a mother of a murdered child. I have that label that I have to wear on my back. Now on my side, my front, my face when I smile, you see a mother of a murdered children. I have three graves that I have to go see that I no longer go see because I couldn't afford tombstones or headstones for my children. I don't have none because it was bearing three children 6 weeks apart and paying for funeral is hard enough. Murderers don't realize what, from the time our child hearing that phone call, someone calling you to tell you that your child been murdered, the feeling that you feel is beyond this world. It's between you and God at that moment. It's between you losing your mind. You actually lose your mind in that second. We actually lose our mind. We snap. It's unbelievable. This has not happened to me. We come out of our body. Our soul is gone. At that moment, everyone thinks that we're supposed to have believe in God and have a religion and must fall down and you will be okay. We're not gonna, I'm not okay. I'm not gonna be okay. This is my child. To hear that, the voice that I heard when they came and told me and I got that call saying my child's murdered, the word murder went from one ear to the other. It went through my brain. It went through this ear, came through my brain to this ear, not knowing, back and forth to my eyes, to my mind, to my body, limping, falling on the floor. The scream that I felt came from the bottom of my feet all the way up to my body, out my mouth, out my mind. I became numb times three. So it's amazing that they say us, the moms, the murdered children, well, you need to be on medication. There's no medication for us. There's no therapy. They want us to do therapy. What are we doing therapy for? What am I going to do therapy for? My therapy is that I have to go to a grave. I had to set a funeral. I had to listen to the rest of my life. I have a baby. They are still my babies. When a mother look at her child, don't matter if they from day one, from an infant to they grown, to they leave this world, is our babies. When we look at them grown man, we're still taking care of our babies for the rest of our lives. Someone took that from me. They took a motherhood. They took my tears. They took my joy. They took my heart. They took my soul. They took everything from me. I saw my children first walk. I heard my baby's first voice. I would never, ever hear the word mommy again for my three sons, ever. When they murdered that day, and I got that call, my word, mommy was taken, the voice was taken from me. My son's tears, I hold in my heart now. My sons never would be married. I never have grandchildren from my sons. Never, ever, ever. They took my image of being a mother from me. How dare you that you can do that to me, to any mother? I have sisters. I joined an organization of mothers that I did not want to join. A club that I did not want it to be in. But I am. And this club that I'm in is powerful. Powerful.
I was diagnosed with triple negative breast cancer. And it's called HER in November 2017. I had surgery in January. It was 7 millimeters. It was stage one, very, very, very early stages. I got it. One of my sisters and I'm from my organization, our organization, Coalition of Concerned Moms. Me and her share the same love and stuff. I had to do the 6 weeks, 4 session of chemo. I started chemo in February and was finished in May. I'm one of those people that, okay, I got this. I'm gonna do this. I zoomed through it. My doctor said I was amazing. Chemo is very extremely hard to do. But the thing about it, when you have a sit down with the doctor, they tell you about what it's gonna do in your life and what the cancer can do and everything. You have to be positive. They want you to be positive and think positive and know that you're going to live, because when you do the chemo, it's like being new life. It takes the life out of you. You get weak, you get sick. You have to bring your boost levers up. You lose your hair. I'm going to take my thing off. I put my little wrap on, but it doesn't even matter, because you know what? This is me. This is how I am. Cancer doesn't have me. I have it. I started radiation on July 9th. I'm zooming through that. I do radiation every day except the weekend. Even though I lost my children, I did wonder and ask God. I said, okay, my children was murdered. So now I'm being diagnosed with cancer. So where do we go from here? So I talked to God. I said, so what are we going to do? I said, because this right here is something new to me. So some days out of my months that I had, I think I cried maybe 3 times that I had cancer. But for me to be a warrior, of a warrior mother of 3 children that were murdered 6 weeks apart, I tell the doctor, I said, this right here is nothing compared to when I lost my children. This right here, I have this. I got this. This is nothing for me. I am delivering, and God, when you look at me and when you show this is what a warrior looked like. This is what power looked like. This is what God created. This is me. I am so happy to be able to do this interview. I am so happy that I can talk about my sons. I am so happy that their voices are being heard. I am so proud that I'm going to be the voices and walk with cancer.
Queen Brown and Burnett McFadden. These beautiful, brave, and heroic women are not alone. All over America, African-American women share their struggle. I hope today's episode shed some light on their journeys, and we will have more stories to share this season. My name is Brad Bailey. I want to thank you for being with us today. Producers are Elias Tavares, Cedric Hill, Pablo De La Hoya, and yours truly, Brad Bailey. Consulting producer is Leonard Tyson. Show design by Madeline Plotnick. I want to thank you again for listening to The Oral History of New York.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Yeah. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Don't punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see. Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
What's going on?
Yeah, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh, what's going on?
What's going on?
Oh,
right now. Right now.
Everybody thinks we're wrong. Oh, but who are they to judge us simply 'cause our hair is long? Oh, you know that we've got to find a way. Bring some understanding here today. Oh, oh, oh. Picket lines and picket signs. Punish me with brutality. Come on, talk to me. You can see what's going on. Yeah, what's going on? Tell me what's going on. I'll tell you what's going on.
Right on. Right on.